special technique. Special technique of shadow boxing.
What's going on? You're here live on Blog Talk Radio. This is the Boxing Sports Radio Show. I am your host, James Bell, lead boxing analyst for the Cold Hard Truth on Sports. Catch articles on thechconsports.com. Once again, that is thechconsports.com. Number to dial in is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. Press one key to get on queue and you'll be able to talk live on the show. Have like a pretty busy show here, as we had like a fairly busy card here in the area where I'm at. I'm, you know, pretty much based in the Washington, D.C. area, and we had the first major fight card at the MGM National Harbor last night. Of course, we were, you know, scheduled to have one on March 11th, but that fight card has been postponed to, it looks like, the month of May. That hasn't necessarily been confirmed yet, but in the, you know, in the meantime, they went on ahead and went forward with this card that was at the National Harbor, and that, you know, was pretty much put down by Top Rank Promotions. Pretty much was a headliner. They put it on, you know, HBO Sports. So you have the HBO boxing team covering it. Was a sellout crowd there in the MGM National Harbor arena that they have there. Was pretty much around shade over 2,800 people in the building, as they had a few things going on there. So they have this card that was headlined by the WBO title fight there in the junior or the super featherweight division there. Where we also had, you know, at least three other fights that were on the, you know, HBO telecast. And they did have a few other fights there with, you know, Jesse Hart fighting there, Mike Reed, Patrick Harris, who is a local guy here around the, you know, the D.C. area. Patrick Harris is the son of Patrice Boogie Harris, who is, you know, fairly known around the boxing circles as, you know, the guy, big guy with the mitts over at Headbangers Gym. So his son, you know, Patrick Harris, was a part of that undercard there. So a lot of people, a lot of local people were, you know, there to see him fight. You know, just like they, you know, have been for his past few fights. You know, he's been over at the, you know, Fort Washington area, the convention center, and the Sphinx Club. And recently, or last year, he was part of the card at the D.C. Armory on April 1st. So he was, you know, included in the undercard for this particular fight card. And the National Harbor in Oxon Hill. But we'll get into, you know, what went down in the fights that were on HBO. As you know, we had like a few kind of well-known guys in the light heavyweight and cruiserweight divisions fighting before the main event, which was in the super featherweight division. Once again, number to dial in to talk boxing is 347-237-5539. Once again, 347-237-5539. Press 1 key to get on cue, and you'll be able to talk live on the show. Just wanted to get into, you know, what was, you know, going on in the undercard of the in the telecast for HBO. We had pretty much the Ukrainian showcase, as I would say it, as you had, like I said, three guys from the Ukraine featured in this particular fight card, and you're pretty much going to start, you know, backwards and then move our way up. You have, you know, Oleksandr Gvozdik, that was out there first in this series, as he was there in the light heavyweight division against Unieski Gonzalez. Unieski Gonzalez was there 18-2. He had, you know, a couple of fights there where he lost to, you know, former champion Jean Pascal and Vyacheslav Shabransky in 2015. But, you know, got a couple of wins after that, and then was here going up against Oleksandr Gvozdik, who came in there as, you know, a minor light heavyweight champion. He has the North American Boxing Federation light heavyweight championship and the vacant NABO light heavyweight championship was on the line here in this fight between Gvozdik and Unieski Gonzalez, and looked like pretty much it was pretty much a not much of a contest there. Looked like, you know, Oleksandr Gvozdik was there. He went in and kind of like took care of business against Unieski Gonzalez. He outlanded Gonzalez by a large margin. Total of 116 punches landed, 256 punches thrown, in comparison to Gonzalez, who landed just 26 punches out of 165 thrown. So, and this was just within three rounds. So you have, you know, Oleksandr Gvozdik scoring a TKO in the third round here. Gvozdik, you know, on top of landing 116 total punches, he landed 68% of his power shots, 72 out of 106. So that is a very, very high connect percentage for power punches, you know, hooks, body shots, and the like, you know, anything that's not a jab. But he, you know, was very, very sharp in reference to that. And taking care of business in that particular case, getting or scoring, you know, that many power shots there against Unieski Gonzalez. You know, while on the flip side, Gonzalez only had, you know, 18 out of 100 shots connect for power shots there for him. So, I mean, it was pretty much a blowout there, and it just improves the record for Oleksandr Gvozdik to 13-0, and this becomes his 11th knockout. Now, Oleksandr Gvozdik does have a couple of other no wins. He did defeat the likes of Tommy Carpentry, Isaac Chalemba, and Najib Mohammadi. You know, a few of these guys, you know, have fought light heavyweight champions. You know, Najib Mohammadi did fight former light heavyweight champion. He did fight the former light heavyweight champion there. You have Tommy Carpentry, who's fought, you know, Chad Dawson, Adonis Stevenson, Andre from Fire, Nathan Cleverley, and the like. Like I was saying before, you did have, you know, a Najib Mohammadi fight Sergey Kovalev, you know, earlier in his career too. So, so here it looks like Oleksandr Vozdek does have, you know, quite a resume here in his young career in the light heavyweight division with just 13 fights. So that was pretty much a blowout win there. He, like I said, you know, this is in the light heavyweight division. He does have the, you know, NABF light heavyweight championship and the NABO light heavyweight championship. So he kind of like moves up the light heavyweight ranks there with the WBO. And I would say the, I probably would say the WBA, but, you know, most likely it will probably be the WBO, where he'll, you know, kind of get up into the rankings there, probably get into the top five if you're not there already. Kind of like chicken. Yeah, he was just a shade under the top five, and WBO is there at number six. IBF is, you know, sitting at number seven, WBA at number eight, and he's there at number four in reference to the WBC. So he's going to kind of be floating around there as far as, like, overall top five within the light heavyweight division. He does, you know, he still could have a few good fights out there before he gets one of those hollow shots against the winner of you know, Adonis Stevenson's fight, and where you still have, you know, Andre Ward and Sergey Kovalev still going at it back and forth. But, you know, with Gavazic having this, you know, great performance there, kind of like blowing out Unieski Gonzalez, they kind of like puts a lot more eyes on him in reference to the light heavyweight division. You know, even though, you know, a few people were kind of new that he was, you know, pretty good already. You know, he was pretty good already, but it's just that, you know, right, you know, with it, with this performance that he's had at the MGM National Harbor, that kind of like, you know, raised a few more eyes on the likes of a few of these boxing fans and, you know, pundits that are out there. So, Oleksandr Gavazic is, you know, somebody to look out for in the light heavyweight division. Kind of like adds to the whole backstory of these Ukrainian fighters, or the fighters from the Ukraine, you know, those that have, you know, went through the Olympics, were very successful in the Olympics and very successful in the amateurs. And so, you know, with Gavazic being one of those guys on the list, this performance that he had last night, kind of like adds to his, you know, overall resume and his overall backstory and how good he is in the ring. Next up, we're just going to, you know, get into which was actually the first featured fight in the HBO telecast. You had Oleksandr Usyk, there is WBO Cruiserweight Champion, defending his title against Michael Hunter. Oleksandr Usyk is a guy that, you know, I pretty much have, you know, talked about off and on, you know, ever since he, was, you know, first mentioned, when he was going up against the, former, WBO Cruiserweight Champion, Krzysztof Kowalski. Of course, we know about Kowalski because of his, upset win over Marco Huck, that, KO win that he had. But when he went up against Oleksandr Usyk, Usyk was, you know, somebody that, you know, once I, you know, kind of like looked at what he was doing, his his resume almost looks similar to the resume of the fighter that held the main event there at the MGM National Harbor. And in the case that he didn't necessarily go into the ring against guys that were like, you know, 1-0 or 0-1 or 0-10 or anything like that. He went against guys that were, you know, kind of semi-veterans in the ring, like, you know, 16-7, 34-15, 24-5, 21-8 within his first five professional fights. But, you know, this was somebody that, you know, had a lot of buzz once he was done with his amateur career, you know, just like Vasily Lomachenko was. And so when he, you know, was able to win a minor cruiserweight belt, you know, in his first, you know, in his first like five fights, they kind of like raised a little bit more eyes towards, you know, what was going on here with Oleksandr Usyk. So, and he just went through a string of TKO victories and KO victories, you know, against guys that, you know, had only a single loss or one loss, something like that. But, you know, all of it was going on in the Ukraine. So it wasn't like, you know, people around the world kind of like knew what was going on with him. But, you know, those within the boxing ranks kind of like knew how good he could probably be. And so he was able to, you know, move on ahead and get that cruiserweight title shot against Christoph Kowalski and pretty much blow him out there, and, you know, have his first, you know, title defense after that by getting a KO win over Tommaso Ciccone at the end of 2016. And so this was his next fight after that against Michael Hunter. And, you know, Michael Hunter was, you know, somebody else that was an Olympian. You know, Hunter was a fairly, I wouldn't necessarily say like an experienced guy, but in reference to, you know, the comparison between him and Oleksandr Usyk, Usyk was further along in his career, even in those short amount of fights, in those 11 professional fights, than Michael Hunter was. I was, you know, bringing up the resume of Oleksandr Usyk and the guys that he was fighting. But when you look at Michael Hunter's resume, it's kind of like the type of fights that you would expect for, you know, someone that's just getting into the professional ranks, you know, guys that were, you know, either had, you know, losing records or didn't have much of a professional record themselves. And so, you know, he was kind of like looking like somebody that they were kind of like bringing up along the ranks and so on and so forth. He did have the unanimous decision win over a cruiserweight contender, Isaiah Thomas, there. You know, battle of two guys that were undefeated, you know, back in May. But he didn't have another professional fight after that until going up against Oleksandr Usyk. And, you know, here in this particular fight, Usyk was, you know, Usyk was supposed to be somebody that, you know, was supposed to, like, you know, outclass him or something like that. But he was able to, you know, get through the 12 rounds against Oleksandr Usyk. He did win the fight by unanimous decision. All three judges scored about 117-110. But I think it was something where, you know, a lot of people kind of expected Usyk to, you know, either like blow away Michael Hunter or at least, you know, score a knockout victory over Michael Hunter, but didn't necessarily get that. Usyk, you know, had a, you know, fairly, you know, average performance overall. He did land 35% of his total punches, with 53% of those that were landed, there were power shots, 239 of 453. On the flip side, Michael Hunter landed about, you know, 24% of his total punches, with like a 28% connect percentage of his power shots, 118 of 418. Usyk kind of like did, you know, close kind of strong there near the end. He did get a standing eight count in the 12th round, and he was looking like he was going to try to finish off Michael Hunter, but Hunter was game, and Hunter was tough there, you know, in the end of the 12th round, and he was able to, you know, survive the end of that round and pretty much make it to the end of the fight. So you kind of like saw, I would say, you know, Usyk basically just get through, you know, just get through, go through the motions, I would say, to get a unanimous decision win. He didn't necessarily go out there to, you know, kind of like bum rush Michael Hunter in this particular fight. I kind of thought that it would be something where we would have saw, you know, the overall difference in, you know, the type of experience that Oleksandr Usyk had in comparison to Michael Hunter when it came to the professional ranks. But I think, you know, both of them kind of like went at it almost like, I wouldn't necessarily like say like two amateurs, but it looks like, you know, some two fighters that were kind of like, you know, wary of what the other fighter could do inside the ring, even though, you know, Michael Hunter didn't necessarily have the type of in-ring experience or, you know, big fight experience that Oleksandr Usyk had. So I think that kind of like was part of a factor there in this matchup between Usyk and Hunter. And so I would say that, you know, you would have something where Usyk kind of like would probably perform different if he went up against somebody that was, you know, higher in the ranks there. Michael Hunter was, you know, ranked number 9 in the WBO. So this was a, you know, kind of like a voluntary title defense. Not necessarily sure what, you know, they were going to do as far as like his future bouts, if he's going to, you know, go after any of the other guys that are, you know, pretty much out there. Of course, you had the WBC Cruiserweight Championship be won by Marius Bartas over Marco Huck earlier, but I don't think that they're going to match those two guys up that quickly. I think, you know, Usyk could probably go up against a Lebedev or IBF champion, Murat Gassiev, later on. I don't see like anyone else that's within the WBO rankings as someone that they would kind of match up Oleksandr Usyk with. So I think his manager, Igis Klimas, will probably look into having him kind of like go back overseas to have a unification bout with one of those two guys, the WBA super champion and Denis Lebedev, or the IBF champion Murat Gassiev, sometime later on this year. All right. Now I'm going to pretty much get into what happened here in the main event between the WBO champion Vasyl Lomachenko there at super featherweight going up against Jason Sosa. Of course, pretty much everyone in the boxing world knows about Vasyl Lomachenko, his extended amateur pedigree, you know, what he's done in the Olympics, and the first, you know, 5 or 6 fights that he's had in his professional career. Of course, he did lose in his second professional fight to Orlando Salido, but he did defeat Gary Russell Jr. and also, you know, moved up in weight to win this super featherweight championship that he has right now, you know, over in the Madison Square Garden. So he did beat Gary Russell Jr. to win one WBO belt. and then from featherweight, you know, defended that WBO featherweight belt a few times and moved up to super featherweight to win the super featherweight title there. Here at the MGM National Harbor, he went up against Jason Sosa. Jason Sosa, of course, notable for fighting Nicholas Walters to a draw in 2015, a majority draw in 2015, which was, you know, kind of a sketchy fight. You had Nicholas Walters coming in there overweight. He did pretty much outperform Jason Sosa, and the judges gave it a majority draw decision there, which, you know, to this day is still being questioned. You know, why they would, you know, have it be a majority draw when Nicholas Walters clearly outperformed Jason Sosa in that particular fight. But after that, Sosa turned around and was able to get the WBA super featherweight championship by defeating the then undefeated champ Javier Fortuna by TKO victory, and then defended it once again in November of 2016, and won a unanimous decision over Stephen Smith. So he had the WBA super featherweight championship, but was relinquished when he signed to fight Vasyl Lomachenko in this particular fight here in the MGM National Harbor. But here, a lot of people expected, you know, Vasyl Lomachenko to pretty much blow away Jason Sosa, like I was saying in the resume of Jason Sosa. He did fight Nicholas Walters, and of course he had, you know, those so-called triangle theories, and, you know, Nicholas Walters outperformed Jason Sosa, even though it was a majority draw. He was outperformed there, and then, you know, when Lomachenko fought Walters, he dominated Walters from, you know, beginning to end, even though Walters didn't necessarily seem like he was, you know, vaguely interested in that particular fight once the fight happened. But Lomachenko was still able to dominate that. And so, you know, people were going into the fight thinking that, you know, Lomachenko was going to pretty much dominate this particular fight. I would say a lot of fans expected Vasyl Lomachenko to fight somebody else, you know, somebody like Orlando Salido or Jezreel Corrales, who, you know, holds another belt in this particular division here at 130 pounds. But those fights didn't end up happening. So he went up ahead. He went on ahead and said, "Hey, just see if you could find somebody, you know, that could fight me." And so they were able to get Jason Sosa, and this was like pretty much I would say it was a boxing clinic, kind of. I mean, you know, Lomachenko was able to get a TKO victory there. You know, but I mean, Lomachenko was just moving around the ring. He kind of, you know, was showing why many people, you know, kind of like place him fairly high in their pound for pound rankings. Or why some people would, I don't know why they would, but they would put him as, you know, number one pound for pound. You know, he was, you know, moving in the ring back and forth, moving laterally, moving left, moving right, throwing punches in different stances. I wouldn't necessarily say different angles. I would say in different stances he was throwing punches. He was able to, you know, just kind of like show that he was a lot better than Jason Sosa is. And it was something that, you know, people expected. Jason Sosa, you know, kind of like looked like he would be kind of game in this particular fight, but the class of fighters, I would say, kind of like showed, you know, when Lomachenko was basically just, you know, outlanding him, you know, outthrowing, and he was just pretty much scoring punches at will, at many different angles. The stats here, I mean, they show that, you know, Lomachenko landed 275 out of 696 punches thrown, with landing 204 power punches out of 351 that were thrown. So he landed nearly 60% of his power shots. And he looked like he was just, you know, kind of like hit, you know, throwing these punches out like two, three at a time before Jason Sosa could, you know, throw out one. In reference to, like, overall punches thrown, it looked like, you know, like I said, 696 total punches thrown within, you know, nine rounds, in comparison to 286 total punches thrown by Jason Sosa within nine rounds. That kind of, like, you know, says that there was no particular counter or answer to, you know, what, you know, what Lomachenko was doing out there in the ring. And there were, you know, a couple of occasions where, you know, Lomachenko was just, you know, basically trying to give a show for the, give a show for the fans out there. You know, there were, you know, times when, you know, he was just, you know, out there, you know, standing, I wouldn't necessarily say standing in the middle of the ring, but kind of like backing towards the ropes. And, you know, he was kind of showing a little, oh, Matador type of stance against his opponent, Jason Sosa, there before, you know, throwing the flurry. So it wasn't like there was any, you know, much danger that Lomachenko had in that particular fight there against Jason Sosa. And, you know, that, you know, kind of like showed that that was a definite mismatch between those two guys. And so Vasily Lomachenko was able to retain the WBO Super Featherweight Championship there. And then, you know, with that, he has his record there with just the one professional loss in his record there. So 7-1 with the lone loss to Orlando Salido that was there in the featherweight division. Let me see if I could get this caller in here. Area code 813. Let me see if I could get you on here real quick. Kind of like looking like my PC, this thing is going a little bit slow. But let me see. 813, you on with us?
Yes, I am. This is Troll checking in from Tampa. How's everything?
Doing okay, man. Doing okay. Just, you know, was going in depth with what was going on at the MGM National Harbor there, and how, you know, Vasily Lomachenko was pretty much, you know, doing what he expected against Jason Sosa. I mean, I didn't expect it to be, you know, much of a match out there. And he pretty much, you know, blew out Jason Sosa and kind of like semi-clowned him in the ring at times there. So were you able to, you know, catch what went down between those two fighters?
Yeah, actually, and as usual, I didn't see this fight due to work constraints. I've read about it in detail at this point and definitely have will definitely be able to watch that this week sometime, and so I can digest it even further. Just to go, I just listened to the last part of your details of the fight on the fact that how Lomachenko was definitely in command of the fight from start to finish. even the point that he was able to virtually toy with his opponent at different times before he took him out and got the knockout TKO and everything. You know, and that's already detailed. So I'm actually going away from that just a little bit. And the reason why I'm going to do that, because already we're seeing a lot of mass media try to put Lomachenko on the pound for pound list as one of the best, you know. And that's admirable or a good mention and stuff like that. But somebody made on a post on social media like, well, he's the best. He's Debbie Blanks on near the top of the pound for pound list. I said, no, hold on, pump your brakes. I totally admire what Lomachenko's doing, and he's doing that. He did, put like this, he proved himself to me when he did with Walters, against Walters. He made an emphatic statement. But to say he belongs on the mythical pound for pound list, I'm not ready to anoint him just yet. And the reasons why is his record. I know he has a ton of amateur fights, but they're just what I just said. They're amateur fights. And so for me, I need for him to show us some sustainability on the pro level with top opponents and keep doing that. And, you know, and the way he's going, if he keeps doing this, by the time he's, 15-1, he should be there at the top of the pound for pound list if he keeps doing this with top-tier opponents. And including moving up in weight, you know, and even the fact that he was toying with his opponent last night, I'm just going to kind of compare the two totally different careers at this point, and two totally different styles. But the fact that you're able to toy with a champion, what's my guy's name from England from back in the day?
Nassim Ahmed.
Totally different careers, but the fact that you're able to play with your opponent in the ring like that. So, and that's totally. And as this really the first time that Loma has really done that. He did that with Walters just a little bit. But Haseem, his style was all about sensationalism, and capture fans, and once again, toying with your opponent. So I said, Loma, he's very technical, very solid. He's not really like that. Like I know that, but just in that the toying aspect is what I'm comparing the two of. But once again, for me, I want Loma to show some sustainability going forward before I say he's almost at or near the top of the pound for pound list. So we will see.
I mean, my thing here with the whole thing about pound for pound list and you know, why he can't be top five is not, I mean, he only has eight professional fights. That's number one. Number two, he's been in just, two particular divisions. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of like look at in reference to, you know, putting somebody within the pound for pound rankings is that either you've, you know, kind of been able to, you know, win in multiple divisions, one, but while you're doing that, you're beating the best guys within that particular division. There's one thing to, you know, say that, you know, a fighter is the best in that in a particular division, but it's another thing than when they actually prove it in the ring, you know. And so I haven't necessarily seen that with Vasyl Lomachenko or, you know, having a big enough body of work for him to do that. You know, yeah, he was able to beat Gary Russell Jr. in the featherweight division, but he also, you know, lost to Orlando Salido in that same particular division the fight before. So it's like, well, yeah, you're able to, you know, defeat this one guy, but you didn't prove yourself in that particular division when you lost to Orlando Salido in the featherweight division. And so instead of, you know, proving that you're better than he is by beating him in that division, you move up and then you kind of like win the same particular belt in another division. And so now here he is at, you know, 130 pounds, and he has another belt at 130 pounds, but he's not necessarily, you know, fighting anybody else in that particular weight division. And I know that there's, you know, something there where, you know, people are saying that, hey, they're not, you know, stepping up to fight this guy. Well, I mean, you have somebody like Orlando Salido that's willing to fight you in that weight class. And you have somebody that's, you know, above him that's willing to fight him in Mikey Garcia. So there are challenges out there for Vasyl Lomachenko. It's just a matter of if he's going to be able to take them on or not. You know, and once he's able to do that and, you know, get more wins under his belt, then maybe he can move up in these pound-for-pound rankings. But as of right now, you can't put him up there, you know, above the likes of Andre Ward or, you know, Terrence Crawford or somebody like that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just, I mean, obviously at this point, well, there's some more fights he can probably get at 130, but he's already made the statement that he wants to only fight champions at this point. I respect that. I mean, my one thing, if you could maybe provide some detail to me, why did he stay amateur so long? You know, was there a lack of opportunity for him to become pro sooner than he did? I mean, I totally respect the fact that he has 2 gold medals, I think 3 world champions as well, but why did he stay amateur so long? I mean, that right there bewilders me. And I mean, just the fact you recall when he did turn pro, he immediately came in and fought for a world title, I believe, on his precedent, you know, unprecedented.
Yeah.
So, but it's like there's definitely fights for him at 130, and he's already made a statement himself that he's looking forward to fighting either Flanagan in his next fight, to trying to unify or secure another title, and definitely wants to fight with Mikey Garcia. And that's something that I'm very interested on seeing in that potential matchup, you know, because going up to 135, keep in mind that Loma's only so much big. He only has so much size. And at that weight class, you're not going to really be growing that much, you know. You're not going to really be outgrowing that weight class. So his motivation is seeking other champions that he can fight. To get secure those great fights that can help define his professional record. But like I said, to me, you already know I'm a huge Mikey Garcia fan, and you already know which one I'm pulling for that in that fight. But just, like I said, there's other fights he can secure. Go and get the Orlando Salido rematch. You guys, if his side needs to concede money, then that's what they need to do. Because that's a fight that Loma himself has said that he does want at some point in time. And we probably would have seen that now if a deal could have been made between the two sides. So, I mean, I'm not taking nothing away from Lomachenko, nothing at all. This guy's doing some outstanding things in the ring. He's doing some beautiful, beautiful boxing that we've seen not in a long time like this. But, and even just a side note as well, there was a mythical matchup that proposed between Lomachenko and Crawford. That's just simply not going to happen. Right now, Crawford's 2 weight classes above him. And even if Loma does make it to 140, Crawford will be at 147 by that time. So to me, that's mythical. And Crawford would be too big for him, too big, too fast, and just as fast to me. Because Loma comes in at what was he, 5'5", 5'6", something like that, right?
Yeah, I think he's around that height, around that height. But you pretty much said, you know, exactly what I was saying in reference to, you know, the potential matchup between Lomachenko and Terrence Crawford. I mean, somebody has, you know, brought that up in you know, boxing boards, and I said the same thing. I said one of the two things is going to happen. I said either Lomachenko is going to reach his peak as far as like when he grows is going to be the 135 pound division, or by the time that he does reach 140, Terrence Crawford will already be in the you know, at 147 pounds by that time, you know. So I don't necessarily think that you know, that particular fight will take place in the future, whether it's, you know, this year or 2 years from now. I think, you know, by 2018, I would kind of see that, you know, that Terrence Crawford will pretty much be in a 147-pound division. I think it's just a matter of time before they just, you know, give him that go-ahead. And I don't understand why they don't have Crawford at the 147-pound division right now. He's, you know, he's already beat who was regarded as the second-best guy there at 140 pounds, and we pretty much know that he's a lot better than who they have out there right now at 140. You have the, you know, two other title holders that are about to fight each other next weekend in Ricky Burns against Julius Ndongo. But, I mean, either one of those guys, you know, whether it's Ricky Burns who wins or, you know, Julius Ndongo who wins, they're not going to be able to beat Terrence Crawford, even if they're going to have a, you know, unification fight later on this year, you know, between those two. I don't think, you know, either one of those guys is going to be able to defeat Terrence Crawford. So it's pretty much like there isn't going to be much else for, you know, Terrence Crawford to prove in that particular weight class. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that's, you know, out there right now in the lightweight division that's going to move up to super lightweight to challenge him. So, I mean, the best move for Terrence Crawford is to go up to 147 pounds and, you know, try his luck there to see if, you know, he's going to be able to, you know, have success in that weight class.
Well, I tell you what, even on speaking of Crawford moving up to 147, so, you know, just go over your reason for moving up anyways. You run out of opponents at your weight class. You're too big for your weight class. It's just a strength where you make the weight anymore. It becomes a somewhat of a danger to your health and your competitiveness in the ring from dropping so much weight. Or, like I said, or back to reason number eight, lack of opponents at that weight class, or you basically cleaned out that division already. So compare the two parallels. I said between, and once again, two totally different careers, but in a sense, in this regard, similar questions between Crawford going to 140, 147, and look at Charlo going to middleweight. So
middleweight,
Charlo,
yeah.
So the one Charlo twin, he basically was struggling to get down to 154. He was already a champion. He was able to defeat emphatically one of his mandatory. In J-Rock, I believe his name is. So at that point, it definitely made sense for him to move up to 160, right? And we already know he definitely has a size for that division. And even on top of that, they gave him so much respect. They gave him, a number two ranking in one of the sanctioning bodies, I believe it was. So in Crawford's case, like I say, he's beat pretty much the best of the best at 140. There's not too many more high profile, well, really, there's probably not any high profile fight for him at 140. So, in essence, what is there left for him to do? Probably not much other than some mandatories and stuff like that, which I think we're seeing right now. But it's like, but even, once again, moving up to a different class, are you ready for that class? So, do you think Crawford's ready for 147?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing right there. And if they, you know, if they have Terrence Crawford moving up to 147 at this point, you know, they're going to have him very highly ranked within the weight classes or the division where he currently holds the title in, which is WBO and the WBC. And of course, you know, right now, currently, you have Manny Pacquiao holding the WBO welterweight championship, and you have Keith Thurman holding the WBC championship. And, you know, of course, you know, for the past couple of years now, that, you know, people have been talking about Terrence Crawford having that shot against Manny Pacquiao, but, you know, that hasn't been, you know, necessarily the case, you know, here. So, I mean, to me, it's going to have to be a matter of time, you know, before, you know, that happens there. Real quick, before I get into the thing with Manny Pacquiao, I have another thing here to talk about in a live session. So for those that are, you know, listening in live on the Go Long Media channel here on Blog Talk Radio, you can call in 347-237-5539. 347-237-5539. One of the other things that I wanted to get into that was happening at the MGM National Harbor was something that was there within that 130-pound weight class. So apparently, you know, out there in the casino, there were a couple of fighters out there joined it up, chewing it up back and forth with each other. And that is the IBF champion, Gervonta Davis, and contender there, Tevin Farmer. I think they were just going at it back and forth and looked like, you know, Tevin Farmer was talking about, hey, he, you know, if you want, hey, I'll be, you know, ready to fight you once you get done with what's going on overseas. Because you have Gervonta Davis going to defend his IBF title overseas against the, you know, number one contender in that particular division there. So if Gervonta Davis is able to, you know, get that win overseas there against Liam Walsh, then Tevin Farmer saying, hey, look, I'm you know, out there. I could be, you know, someone who is your voluntary title defense. You know, Liam Walsh is sitting at as a mandatory for Gervonta Davis right now with Tevin Farmer there ranked number six. And one of the things that Gervonta Davis was bringing up is like, man, it's like you already have four losses already, you know, in your on your resume. So you need to like get your resume up or something like that. Now those four losses did happen early in Tevin Farmer's career. And he hasn't, you know, lost in a while, but what Gervonta Davis is saying is that you need to, you know, get some better guys, you know, on your resume before, you know, trying to challenge him for that IBF belt that he has. So what was your thoughts about, you know, this little back and forth banter between those two? I mean, nothing physical happened between those two guys, but they were pretty much at each other's faces for a good amount of time, you know, talk a little bit of trash though.
Yeah, I was not aware that this happened until you made mention on that on the a message you sent in the group earlier. And actually, as you're talking about right now, I'm looking at that on just dust up on YouTube as it's going down. And just taking a quick look at the rankings, of course, we got Gervonta Davis as being the champion in the IBF organization, and Tevin Farmer being he's ranking number six in that organization. So it's funny. I mean, this is boxing. This is boxing where you can talk you into a fight by showing up at someone's press conference, meaning a run across the path, another fight at an actual fight. And I mean, this is boxing. And basically, Tevin's trying to talk his way into a fight. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, look, you're going at directly at the guy that's the champion in the organization that you're ranked in. So why not go at him? So he's just basically trying to generate public interest and defend the plans to give him a fight. There's nothing wrong with that. So it's funny. And like I said, as I'm looking at it right now, it didn't get physical, but you can just tell that Gervonta Davis is really getting aside himself, getting upset, the fact that this guy's calling him out, and the fact that like he has four losses already, you know. But and once again, yeah, it goes back to a point that we always bring up. Just because you have a loss doesn't mean you're dead, you know. I mean, this guy's great.
Yeah.
And he just came early within his career, but still kind of four is a number to consider. So with that, I would want to take a closer look at Tevin Farmer to see what his last five fights are. Hope he's on undefeated streak. Hope he's knocking guys out to draw attention to himself. And well, like I said, this stuff right here, everyone watching, this is boxing, man. Classic boxing. From the movies to the real life.
Yep. And the thing here with Tevin Farmer, he has his record there at, you know, 24-4-1. He has, like, five knockout victories there. You know, last four fights he's had has been, you know, unanimous decision victories. One of the, you know, the latest loss that he did have was against Jose Pedraza, who in turn was the guy that Gervonta Davis beat in order for Davis to win that IBF Super Featherweight Championship. So that was probably one big talking point that Gervonta Davis had over Tevin Farmer once. You know, those two were going back and forth with each other there last night at the National Harbor. Yeah, I think, like you were saying, it is part of boxing. The talking and, you know, going after fighters is a part of boxing, has been a part of boxing for years. It's just that we're going to see here what's going to be, you know, happening here with in reference to Tevin Farmer. And so I think what Farmer is trying to do is trying to, you know, get into a verbal agreement between him and Davis. They have Tevin Farmer here in, scheduled to have a fight over in his hometown in Philadelphia on April 29th. And you do have Gervonta Davis, like I said, going up against Liam Walsh for that IBF belt. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, a few fight fans are looking towards to see what Gervonta Davis does when he's overseas there to defend his belt. And so, if he's able to, you know, get through that, then, you know, maybe he's able to, you know, have that voluntary defense against Tevin Farmer. And, you know, with those guys, you know, being, you know, kind of close to each other, you know, Farmer being in Philadelphia and Gervonta Davis being from Baltimore, they kind of like, you know, we're pretty much a good fight crowd to one of those venues that we have around here. Of course, you know, we have MGM, we have, you know, DC Armory around here. You got, you know, venues in Philadelphia, venues in New York, New Jersey, and all of that. So that would be a good, you know, East Coast fight that would bring a good amount of, you know, fight fans for people to see what happens between those two guys. But, I mean, to me right now at this point, it looks like, you know, Gervonta Davis is kind of like working on a, you know, little streak here, you know, going through, you know, who he's gone through in that particular division. And, you know, if it wasn't for, you know, Vasyl Lomachenko hanging out there in that particular division, I think more people would think about having Gervonta Davis near the top of that particular weight class.
Yeah, and just like I said, that would be a great East Coast fight, and it kind of takes me back a bit to the 90s where you had people like Pernell Whitaker, a lot of other Philadelphia fighters, people like that, had a strong presence for their coast. You know, it's just funny. Just as much as things are different, things are the same. So it would be great to see a good uprising come from the East Coast from people like this, fights like this. So I definitely hope that it can be made. Looking forward to it. Hope they can secure a fight, you know. And just what,
yep.
I keep joking with you too, but it's just so funny. The area where you live at is just a lot of boxing activity, boxing news comes from where you live at. So for these guys to have this little dust up, it is something increases the presence of boxing on the East Coast, you know?
I mean, it's like, you know, this is, you know, slowly become, you know, a boxing haven for a lot of these, you know, high profile fights. And then when you have a few of these guys that have been, you know, fairly successful in the boxing division and holding these belts, then that kind of like adds to, you know, what we have out there in the DC area. And of course we have, you know, a few of these notable boxing gyms here. So that kind of like adds to the, you know, whole background with Washington DC. And I mean, of course, you know, they've had notable fighters be here in this area in the past, but, you know, now with, you know, the guys like the Peterson brothers and, you know, now Gervonta Davis and the like, that kind of like boost the overall MO for the sport of boxing there.
Yeah, definitely throwing Gary Russell Jr. in there too.
Seems like pretty much stepping into the overtime portion here of the show. And what I wanted to get into was this here thing. I did, like, mention this on Twitter earlier this week that it looks like it'll be closer to, you know, being official that the WBO welterweight champion Manny Pacquiao will end up facing Jeff Horn there. And it will look like that will be on July 2nd over in the Suncorp Stadium there in the Australia area. So they had this recent article that's on Boxing Scene. They're saying that they're going to try to fit around 55,000 fans there in the stadium, and that, you know, the weekend or the July 2nd weekend would kind of like bring a overall profit of $24 million to the Queensland area in Australia. You know, but like I was saying, I was kind of, you know, disappointed that this particular fight would end up happening. Of course, a lot more people would be, you know, more accepting towards a fight between Manny Pacquiao and Amir Khan. But, I mean, there was only, like, you know, a few people that could really approve a fight like that. And Bob Arum is pretty much the number one guy that would approve it. And he didn't. And he had no intentions of making that fight happen. So the whole thing with, you know, Manny Pacquiao and Jeff Horn was pretty much closer to fruition, and it's going to pretty much go down. One of the things that I was kind of surprised about is, you know, not only is Jeff Horn the number two guy in the WBO, but he's ranked number two within the IBF as well. So that's kind of, like, interesting there because you really haven't, like, seen – you know, much of note coming from Jeff Horn in reference to, you know, who he's fought over the course of his I think that was, like, kind of interesting there that they would put Jeff Horn that high in the rankings within the IBF and the WBO, you know, while only having 17 professional fights, one, and two, he's, you know, only fought in New Zealand and Australia. So I think that's pretty much interesting. He's, you know, fought, like, you know, veterans Randall Bailey and Ali Faneca, but that's to me, that's pretty much the two, you know, the only two notable guys that I see, you know, pretty much on his resume. And, you know, those two guys, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they really haven't, you know, had, you know, much of, you know, a notable career. with the exception of, you know, Ali Faneca. I mean, Faneca is, like, fought guys back in 2008, where he's had, you know, title fights or world title fights. But ever since then, you know, you really haven't, you know, heard much about him since then. So that kind of, like, goes into why a lot of people think that this fight between Manny Pacquiao and Jeff Horn is an absolute mismatch.
So let me ask you a question. So, I mean, we've been playing with the idea of this fight, and now at this point, it's now finally here. We're going to be faced with having these two guys fight. Like I said, this Jeff Horn guy in the WBO, he's ranked, where's he at? Six or something like that, whatever. And actually, I don't know why I'm looking at the IBF rankings right now. They're number two says not rated for whatever reason. But aside from that, I mean, for me, the bare bones of this matchup is all about money, and not just that, but just trying to make as much money off Pacquiao as they can before he leaves, before he retires. And I'll look at that a little more closely. And obviously, in order to elongate your career and get people to pay money to see you fight, you want to match somebody up with somebody that's you know you're going to beat. And just on paper, these two do not belong in the same ring together. I know that, you know that, and even a casual fan looking at a matchup sheet would be able to know that. you know, based on the quality of opposition, based on managed accomplishment since he's been in boxing, they do not blow in the same ring. So this looks like, and even going back to what you said about the proposed matchup between Pacquiao and Khan, and how Bob Arum basically said, nope, not going to happen. Because in that case, what he's doing, he's protecting his product. He doesn't want any potential slip-up or a chance for Manny to get tarnished, to look old, to get touched up, to get knocked out. He doesn't want that to happen. So he has to protect his product at all times. And what that means for him, it's making the right matchup, going to the right money setup to secure fights, to elongate his career and make as much more money Pacquiao as he can.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason why we didn't see a Pacquiao Crawford matchup, because I mean, of course, bottom line, you always have to fight. I mean, I could sit and say Crawford will kill him, but they still have to fight. You never know. But at the same time, stylistically, that is not a good look for Pacquiao. So it's a shame that we have to digest this fight. Like I said, bottom line, they do not belong in the same ring at all. And one thing I'm looking at money-wise is like the fact they're going to try to get 50 to 55,000 people within that stadium. Of course, that's going to draw a good amount of money for the ticket, for the purses. But at the same time, who else could Manny have fought now to be on pay-per-view and to generate a good number in pay-per-view? You know, who else could he have fought now? Of course, we already know Crawford. We know that. But who else would Pacquiao fight that would generate that number? But really, it doesn't matter because Aaron's going to carefully match him up anyways. So once again, they can just keep his career going and make that money.
Yeah. And one big point that you did bring up in reference to the fight in general is that the overall plan of Top Rank and Bob Arum is to kind of like match up Manny Pacquiao with, you know, guys like a Jeff Horn who kind of like fits what they're looking for right now at this point. Number one, they're trying to see if they could, you know, get some international money against a guy that, you know, they are, you know, absolutely confident that Manny Pacquiao could beat. And so, you know, him going to, you know, Australia or something like that, in order to, you know, get a fight that would kind of generate a buzz with, you know, area where they don't necessarily have those type of high profile fights. I mean, they just recently, you know, got Joseph Parker to, you know, win the WBO heavyweight championship. But other than that, you really haven't, you know, heard much in reference to the New Zealand area or Australia area having a, you know, a major world title holder. And so now, you know, here they have another opportunity to, you know, bring a high-profile fight over to Australia. And this would be, you know, the easiest way for them to do it is to, you know, have a contender like a Jeff Horn go up against Manny Pacquiao, where, you know, Manny Pacquiao has the name and he has the backing in order to bring that many people to an arena like that. If you, you know, have anybody else that's out there in the welterweight division right now, they're not going to bring, you know, 50 to 55,000 people to a stadium in Australia. So, I mean, that's not going to happen unless if it was Manny Pacquiao. So I think that was, you know, something that kind of, that was something that, like I was saying, that Bob Arum was looking for Manny Pacquiao, you know, at this point of his career. You know, before he's, you know, done with the current contract that he has there with Top Rank. A couple of other things here that I wanted to touch into, pretty much like, you know, run through them here in succession. Number one, we pretty much know what's going to happen now within the light heavyweight division. We did have an early announcement a few days ago that you're going to have Adonis Stevenson have a rematch with Andre Fonfara on June 3rd for that WBC light heavyweight championship. So you're going to have that as a rematch there for one light heavyweight championship. And on the flip side, on June 17th in Mandalay Bay, you're going to have the rematch between Andre Ward and Sergey Kovalev for pretty much the other major belts within the light heavyweight division there. Of course, there was a lot of, you know, noise back and forth between those two. Well, mainly, you know, on Kovalev's side ever since the results of the last fight. And that, you know, Ward is like saying he's going to retire and he's a coward and he's this and he's that. And then, you know, Ward's just saying, okay, yeah, we'll just go ahead and have this rematch. Let's make it official. And so now Kovalev is still out there talking trash, talking about he's going to finish the job and remember, you know, remember me putting you on the mat in the first fight and all that type of stuff there. So light heavyweight division is, you know, kind of been, you know, fairly busy here within the past few weeks or so. Like I said, I had, you know, Oleksandr Gvozdik, you know, win his fight here at the MGM National Harbor there. And then on the, you know, backstory to that, you have the news of these two light heavyweight championship fights basically be formally announced there between those guys. And the one other thing here that I wanted to touch on was there's supposedly going to be a fight on June 10th that was going to be for the middleweight titles. It was supposed to be Gennady Golovkin facing Billy Joe Saunders. It was going to be on June 10th in Kazakhstan. But it seems like they say that Frank Warren, who is the manager or the promoter of Billy Joe Saunders, was told by Golovkin's team that an injury Golovkin has delayed the completion of their deal for them to the fight. So, you know, on their side, they're saying that Golovkin is injured there. And that's kind of weird there because, you know, Golovkin has just been coming out of that fight between him and Daniel Jacobs where, like I said, Daniel Jacobs won that fight. But if there's any truth to the matter that Golovkin is injured in this particular fight, then that kind of like, you know, throws a little wrench in that whole little deal about Golovkin and his MO about trying to say he wants all the belts in the middleweight division, number one. And then number two, what does that do in reference to a potential match between him and Canelo Alvarez that was scheduled for September? But there's been a lot of, you know, roadblocks in the way between from that fight being official. So, you know, those were the, you know, news tidbits that I wanted to add in here. Terrell, you wanted to, you know, have a response to what's happening there in the light heavyweight division or what's going down between Billy Joe Saunders and Gennady Golovkin?
Yeah, definitely. We'll definitely look at both of those that you proposed. Starting back with, like I said, with light heavyweight, you got Adonis Stevenson sitting there at the champion in the WBC. Fun Fire sitting there at number nine within that organization. You also got Adonis Stevenson's countryman, Elider Alvarez. He's sitting at number one after his win over, I believe, Lucien Boutte in the last fight within the last couple of months and stuff like that. Stevenson had somewhat of a verbal agreement to fight some other guy. I forgot the other guy's name. I think he's from overseas or something like that. And all of a sudden, they dropped the news that Stevenson was going to fight for Fara. And which upset that party. But, I mean, we know that Fara gave Stevenson a tougher than expected fight, despite the fact that Fara got knocked down. He was able to knock down Stevenson in, the 11th round as well. And Stevenson basically got out of there with a win, where some people thought that he didn't necessarily deserve that and everything. So do I mind saying that? No, I don't. And the reason why, because Fonfero gave Stevenson a tough fight. So so I'm definitely glad to hear about this rematch. Back in regards to the fight between the rematch between Ward and Kovalev, quite simply, I'm glad that it got they finally got the deal done. It upset me the fact that there was mention of Ward retiring for lack of respect and things like that. I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to hear that at all. But aside from all the banter, I'm glad that's a rematch. And understandably, Kovalev is upset that he lost his belts. He's upset that he lost the fight. So, aside from all the banter, let's get it done. It's already the deal's done. It's about waiting it out and getting back in the ring. And in this case, I think this rematch will be better than actual first fight. A lot of times we'll see a rematch, and it lacks that lackluster and firepower that two opponents can generate within one fight. In this case, I think that Kovalev is going to take a lot more chances and go directly at Ward. And with that said, I'm thinking Ward's already expecting that. But Kovalev, he's basically going to say, well, I knocked him on one time. I'm not wasting no time. I'm going right after him and try to get him out of there. So we're going to really see how that works. And like I said, I think the rematch would definitely be better than the first fight. So I definitely can't wait for that. In regards to the Gennady Golovkin situation, we talked about this some this week earlier with him and Saunders and things like that. And I haven't heard anything about any supposed injury that Golovkin has. And not until you just mentioned that to me right now. We know that Canelo is his dream right now, to get Canelo in the ring, hopefully beat him and gain that notoriety by being a Canelo. And we already know the story of Canelo vacating, going up and down, catchweight fights, things like that, and so on. And basically anything he's been doing, anything and everything to delay the fight with Golovkin. But do I believe Golovkin's injured? No, I don't. I don't believe that for 1 minute, because if that was the case, that would have been from the Jacobs fight. And typically when we see a high-profile fight, somebody injured their hand within the fight or something like that, we typically hear about that very, very soon after the fight. For example, Wilder's fight, we know he tore a bicep, and I believe what his other injury was, we heard about that right away. So for them to manufacture an injury with Golovkin, I'm not going for that. Because to me, what they're trying to do is buy it out more time, not take a fight for the summer, and so he can sit back and see what happens between Canelo and Chavez Jr. And I think their expectations, if Chavez Jr. wins it, I'm sorry, Canelo wins that fight, then all of a sudden, oh, I'm not injured anymore. I'm ready to fight right now. Let's go sign. I think they're just trying to get into position to do that, you know. Mm-hmm. But with Saunders, I mean, I would have loved to see that. And like you said before yourself, you would think that Golovkin would jump at the opportunity to unify. You would think he would. But here he is now, once again, and I'm, in a sense, ducking and citing an injury that we didn't know about, you know, until now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this middleweight pitcher is a mess. And just to me, it's just filled with a bunch of divas at this point, with Canelo leading the charge, being a diva. And this goes back to last year when we talked about who's the A side, who's the B side, who's trying to get in position to say I'm the best and things like that. So this is all about the positioning, going back and forth between two sides. It's like a game. It's starting to be like, is this chess or boxing? I can't tell sometimes.
Well, I mean, you know, it's been mentioned that, you know, those two particular, I wouldn't necessarily say sports, but those particular things have been, like, compared with each other. But it does look like, you know, Canelo and his team has been the one that's been the quote-unquote better chess player in this particular case. They're the ones that are holding all the pieces in the potential fight between him and Gennady Golovkin. And, you know, right now it seems like they're the ones that are kind of pulling the strings in what Golovkin is doing. You know, with Golovkin, you know, not necessarily being, you know, eager to go ahead with this fight between him and Billy Joe Saunders, that kind of like plays into the hands of what Canelo and Oscar De La Hoya wanted, because one thing that, you know, I discussed a couple of weeks ago was that Oscar De La Hoya was not necessarily down with a potential fight between Gennady Golovkin and Billy Joe Saunders on June 10th because he was saying then that, hey, what if something happens with Gennady Golovkin in this fight between him and Billy Joe Saunders? What if he gets injured? Then that would kind of delay what happens between him and Canelo Alvarez. And so it's kind of funny that, you know, now with this whole thing about Golovkin and Billy Joe Saunders kind of being potentially being shot down because of a quote-unquote injury to Gennady Golovkin. So that kind of like plays into the story of, you know, what's happening, you know, there in the middleweight division. And I do agree that there is a lot of divaness, so to speak, going on in that particular division. And in reference to, you know, what's going to happen with Andre Ward and Sergey Kovalev, I think that Sergey Kovalev is going to, you know, have a different approach to this fight here in this rematch. I did like the first fight between those two. It was a, you know, pretty good tactical fight between those two, I would say, with, you know, Andre Ward being the one to kind of like get the upper hand at the second half of the fight. I kind of expected Sergey Kovalev is going to approach this second fight a little bit different. Hopefully, I would like to see if he's going to approach the fight here like I thought he would do in the first fight, and that is to say that he's the one that is the light heavyweight that's going in here. He was the one that was there as the light heavyweight champion. You know, Andre Ward was coming in there as super middleweight, so I thought that, you know, that Kovalev would, you know, use his size for his advantage, use his size, use his reach, but he didn't do that. And so, you know, now I want to see if he's going to be able to do, you know, both of those things here in this rematch to make this fight a little bit tougher for Andre Ward. So that is something that I'm waiting to see in that particular case here in this rematch that's going to happen. All right. On that note, I'm pretty much in this episode, and we're going to be setting up for what's going to be going on next week when we're going to preview the fight card that's going to be at the Barclays Center on April 22nd. So we're going to preview that particular fight card there as you have the WBC Welterweight Eliminator there between Sean Porter and Andre Berto. And you're going to have Luis Ortiz added to that fight card too. And then you have Charles Hatley going up against Jermell Charlo there for the WBC light middleweight championship or super middleweight championship there. So going to be previewing those fights there on the show next week. So be sure to catch that show on Sunday at 7:30 here on the Go Long Media channel on Blog Talk Radio. And like I say, to close every show, Point of Boxing is a hit and not get hit, not the same trade. On that note, I'm out. Have a good night.
Yep.